It's the Security Weekly News, and it's episode 271, which adds up to the number 10, which is an A in hexadecimal, which probably means it's the end times. But I'm Doug White, and it's Friday on the week of 29 January 2023. We've got ChatGPT, QNAP, Google Fi, I don't know, Redis, Headcrab, Banner, GoodRx, or I don't know if you pronounce it Good Prescription, Oracle, Go Anywhere, and more on the Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week, your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
How is your business staying one step ahead of cyber criminals? Secure your email, applications, network, and data with Barracuda. Protect your business and go from zero to security in no time flat. Whether your team is working in one location or many, Barracuda has solutions that are easy to buy, deploy, and use. Learn how Barracuda can protect your business against ransomware, phishing, and other cyber attacks. Visit securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. Barracuda, your journey secured. All right, it's the Security Weekly News. Well, we haven't heard from QNAP for a while. I mean, a couple of years ago, it was like every other week we were doing a story on it. But here we go. This report says there are tens of thousands, and they keep escalating the numbers. So they say tens of thousands, but wait and see. Tens of thousands of QNAP NAS devices, which have not been patched since a critical vulnerability was announced on Monday. Which is not that surprising because Monday wasn't that long ago. The vulnerability will allow the injection of code if your QNAP devices are internet facing, or I guess even if they're not, but they tend to get attacked more if they're internet facing. And of course, they shouldn't be internet facing, but well, they may be. And if they are, well, you know, patch them. But the flaw has a CVSS score of 9.8, which is, you know, in technical terms, bad. Actually, it's worse than bad. And it was described as a low complexity attack. So Census said that only 550 of the 60,000. So when they said 10,000, then they suddenly say 60,000. They only 550 of the 60,000 NAS devices they found online had been patched so far. So that also bad. They were able to obtain the version number on 30,000 or so of these hosts, and they said that 98% of the devices they found in that 30,000 block were actually vulnerable to this problem. So far, there's not a proof of concept out on this, but there probably will be soon. So if you have a QNAP device, and there are version numbers and other things in the article, you definitely need to patch it because these are heavily targeted by ransomware gangs who search, you know, using Showdown or whatever, and then they find it and they come in and ransomware all your data. So QNAP has also advised that you should disable port forwarding on your router. So if you are port forwarding to your NAS device, and a lot of people do that so that they can back up data wherever they are, and they open port forwarding on their home routers and so forth. They also said you should disable UPnP on your QNAP device. So two big tips, but mostly there is a patch. You can patch this thing, and if you don't have it outward facing, please patch it now. If you use Google Fi or Fum, I smell bourbon. No, that doesn't rhyme. I can't rhyme. But however you say it, Fi said that personal data had been exposed at one of its primary network providers, and they issued a warning to some customers. So they theoretically have issued you a warning if you're subject to this. But they said this could allow a SIM swapping attack. Notices were sent out to customers stating that their phone numbers, SIM card numbers, and other information about their accounts was compromised. And of course, if you have the phone number and the SIM card number, that's pretty easy to SIM swap. They did say that there was no sensitive information. Well, yeah, okay. But they said no sensitive information like social security numbers and tax IDs and all the account passwords and all that was not compromised. but they did lose your SIM card serial number. So if they have your SIM card number and your phone number, going into a place or having a place to do this will allow you to set up, or you could, I guess, make your own SIM cards. One customer said that hackers had gained access to their Authy MFA because if it's SMS, so that SMS text that comes in for your multi-factor authentication, and that's how SIM swapping works, right? So they request a password reset, the multi-factor kicks in, an SMS text message is sent to the phone, which if it's been SIM swapped, then basically they see it too. They can punch in the code and boom, Bob's your uncle. And so there's a big problem with this. SIM swaps are really nasty if you think about how much things your phone actually controls, and with multi-factor, which has been put in place everywhere. You can try and use things like physical MFA tokens like YubiKeys and that, or they recommended authenticator apps because most of the authenticator apps are not going to work the same way and they're not as subject to SIM swapping, or are they? But if you're using SMS text for multi-factor, there are many, many ways that can be intercepted, up to and including just social engineering it. So they do that a lot, and they just call people and say, tell me the code that prints on your phone, and you know, and then they got you. So, yeah. 1,200 or more Redis database servers have been compromised by a piece of malware since September of 2021. The malware was identified by Aqua Nautilus Security, who named it Head Crab, whatever that means. Sounds awful. Or like something you eat. I don't know. It could be awful. Yeah, it needs better marketing. But Head Crab. They described it as being meticulously built and mostly undetectable by both agentless and conventional antivirus. So pretty nasty. They went on and said the attackers have a deep knowledge of Redis modules and APIs. The malware runs, it's in memory only, and it's never written to the disk, which makes it even harder to detect. It also then acts to delete log entries and communicates with legitimate IP addresses. And they didn't say exactly what that meant. I presume it's connecting to things that are in the cloud or whatever. Aqua Nautilus said that there were 2,800, it's another one of these number things. There are between 2,800 and 43,000, so a pretty big range of servers still at risk of exploitation. So I'm presuming, I don't know how they came up with 2,800 to 43,000, but whatever. The ultimate purpose of this malware seems to be to build a botnet for crypto mining, but the nature of the malware means that it can easily do whatever. So once it's on your system, it has the ability to, you know, actually execute shells, load other modules. It can load fileless kernel modules and perform data exfiltration. So very, very nasty stuff. Redis, if you're not familiar with it, is an open source tool that can be used as a database. It's like a headless database, a caching tool, or a messaging broker. So it has a lot of different purposes in the industry. And it was never designed to be exposed to the internet. And the reason for that is it doesn't perform authentication. So it was designed to be a back-end tool that was protected. So you need to run it in a walled-off network and never, ever expose it to the internet, according to Redis itself, which makes a lot of sense to me. But people expose these things, and then they're vulnerable big time. So be careful if you're using Redis. And I don't. It didn't say if they had patches out to prevent this exploit or whatever. But, you know, watch out. Banner Health agreed to pay $1.25 million fine with the Office of Civil Rights because it was determined that a HIPAA violation had occurred after they had a large 2016 data breach. So this takes years for this to sort itself out through all these different agencies. Now, HIPAA, if you're not familiar, stands for the Health Insurance Portability and Accounting Act in the United States, and it requires all these different privacy means on healthcare providers. Banner Health has more than 50,000 employees and is the largest employer in the U.S. state of Arizona. The investigation of the breach, which took a while, said that Banner Health failed to perform risk analysis for the electronic protected health information and did not employ sufficient monitoring for its health IT systems to protect against cyber threats. Imagine that. The data of 2.81 million parties from 27 different Banner health systems locations was exposed when the payment processing system at their food and beverage outlets were compromised. They did not detect this intrusion for more than a month, which again, I mean, even in 2016, that was not at all uncommon to see these kind of things. But in addition to the fine, they have agreed to implement a corrective action plan that includes specific steps the security teams will take to resolve all the HIPAA failures that were found in the investigation. The estimate is that with the $1.25 million settlement, that's a fine, the incident has cost the company over $10 million because a federal judge previously had approved an $8.9 million settlement with victims in 2020. Now, one of my gripes with all this stuff, of course, is that the fine is basically like a parking ticket for me. Because, you know, since the only I went and looked for some financials on Banner Health, but the only one I could find showed total revenues of over $9 billion with a B dollars in 2019. So a $1.25 million fine or even a $10 million cost is kind of not a real penalty. I mean, obviously they imposed other things on them to make them do better, but you know, not much teeth in that, but for all I know, that's the maximum they could fine them. I don't know what the rule actually says, but it sounds bad to me. If I had to pay $10 million, I would end up in the workhouse because I don't have $10 million. I don't have $1 million, so I would end up in the workhouse, but you know, $9 billion in revenues, you know, you could probably, you know, pay that out of petty cash and move on. Since we're doing, which also bothers me because then they'll say, oh, we can't afford to do the cybersecurity. You know, it's like, oh yeah, we have $9 billion in revenues. We just couldn't afford the cybersecurity needs. Yeah, we've all heard that, right? Well, since we're doing fines anyway, the Federal Trade Commission in the United States fined GoodRx, and I don't know if you pronounce that good prescription because R with a little X after it in the U.S. means prescription, but GoodRx was fined $1.5 million for questionable privacy practices, which involve sharing personal consumer health data with Facebook, Google, and Twilio. Face it, folks, they're going to sell your data, and the other people are going to buy your data. I mean, it's going to happen. William Gibson saw this coming along back in the 80s. William Gibson was writing about this stuff. According to the article, the fine was a first of its kind action by the FTC. GoodRx is a telehealth and prescription drug provider, and they were barred under the action from unauthorized consumer data disclosures and have been told to instruct Facebook and the other recipients of the data, and there was a whole list of them, that they need to delete that information. Oh, yeah, that'll happen. But they're supposed to send them, I guess, a cease and desist letter saying you must delete this data that we sent you or sold you because they were selling it. They have also been required to limit retention of customer data in the future, implement a data privacy program, and acquire user consent before any health information is disclosed. So, you know, that read it before you click it thing. So now there will be a pop-up box that says, and you know, all this, and you have to give us your kidneys kind of thing, and you click it. But once again, an unverified, I went out and I found an unverified one-year slice of their revenue was $795 million. So again, a $1.5 million fine isn't much, but I guess at least they're being ordered to make corrections and stop doing this, at least, you know, until they figure out another way to do it, because I'm sure they have a whole swarm of lawyers who are rapidly trying to figure out a way they can do this anyway. So, you know, obviously I'm a little nasty about people selling data without your permission, but they do it all the time. So we're all kind of used to it. Oracle's e-business suite is a supply chain management and enterprise resource planning tool along with a customer relationship management tool, which is SCM, ERP, and CRM. So you've probably heard those acronyms before. A critical severity vulnerability has been found and proof of concept code has been published. This vulnerability, also like the one we talked about earlier, has a score of 9.8 and is in, wait for it, the Web Application Desktop Integrator. And, you know, so once again, a web GUI that they put in their product that was never intended to be exposed to the internet is being exposed to the internet. And of course, these things just over and over, different companies we've seen, all these holes in this stuff. The actual vulnerability was patched in October of 2022, but of course, people don't patch it. A NIST advisory on it said that unauthenticated attackers with network access via HTTP, and how many of you have port 80 open? A lot. So people that have access via HTTP can exploit the security defect to compromise the web application's desktop integrator and take it over, which would be, in technical terms, bad. CISA added this exploit to its known exploited vulnerability there of things being exploited in the wild, and CISA went on to urge Oracle customers to patch as soon as possible. The first exploit attempts were observed on the 21st of January, according to Shadow Server. Vital cybersecurity in Vietnam, or it may be Viettel, I think it's Viettel, cybersecurity in Vietnam published the proof of concept on 16 January, so expect much more targeting of this particular tool as we move forward. So patch and patch often. Go Anywhere, secure managed file transfer software, you know, one of those things everybody's always looking for, has a zero-day exploit that can be targeted via the internet connection. Wah, wah. The product, which is made by Fortra, was originally called Help Systems, and probably will get a new name again soon, and it's designed to allow automation and secure exchange of data with trading partners. So this was basically a replacement for FTP type stuff. Brian Krebs broke this story yesterday and said that it can only be accessed by authenticated users who can access the administrative console of the application. So maybe not as bad as some things, but nevertheless, if somebody has access, and you know, how many people have you granted access to this stuff anyway? But it is a remote code injection exploit. The vendor said that the vulnerable console should typically only be accessible from within the company's network. Once again, they also went on and said, or through a VPN or by approved IP. So basically they're saying, you know, yeah, that people are having access to this through every possible channel. You know, and we know how that ends every single time. Once you expose these administrative consoles, they've got problems, they get compromised, and boom. So you should not be exposing these consoles on the open internet. You know, but when people had to go work from home, and we all still have all kinds of remote stuff. In fact, I noticed that today, it feels like Edmonton outside because it's cold and windy. And I, for the first time ever, I saw schools in New England closing because it's cold. I was like, wait, what? It's Boston. You're closing school because it's cold? I've never heard of that before. But anyway, because we have all this remote capability now, we all have employees wanting to work from home, students wanting to take classes from home, and so forth. And every time that happens, we end up opening more services to people from home. So you're going to have to really go out and carefully review this stuff going forward. You've got to protect these web GUIs, I'm telling you, because every week we could do a story about one of these things, and we do them all the time. Management VLAN, come on. I mean, set that up. But Kevin Beaumont said a Shodan search found more than 1,000 exposed systems, which were mostly in the United States, but did say that some of these were a different web client that that they could not distinguish which one it was, that Fortra says is, or Fortra says is not affected. So, you know, I mean, you need to do some review on this, really. I mean, start reviewing some of your console stuff and see if you have these kind of problems. Well, the threat of the week is going to be, let's call it fear of the unknown. Ludditism? I don't know. I didn't get to do this last week because we had a special guest, which was awesome, but I'll do it now. I said I was going to do it last week, but then we had a special guest. I mean, you know, we're all afraid of the unknown, right? I mean, what is that weird? What's in that weird dish at the Duck's Blood Soup restaurant? I highly recommend the Duck's Blood Soup restaurant in Futsubiao in Nanjing, but it's really good. I don't know what was in it, but it was actually really good. And it's not as weird as it sounds. But I mean, sometimes apprehension's a good thing. Like, you know, this thing with lots of tentacles wiggling, maybe you don't want to eat that. There was no tentacles in that. But sometimes you just have to hope it's not too steep and your skis will stay on the hill or you'll miss out on something good. But if you've been under a technological rock for like the last 2 months, you probably haven't heard of ChatGPT, but most of us have, and I have, and I've been using it a lot. I mean, I really got into the DALL-E stuff with the art, and then ChatGPT has just been wowing me over and over again. I attached an article which provided a list of schools and colleges that have banned, and that's air quotes, they banned ChatGPT. You know, they said, no ChatGPT. I'm like, oh yeah, that'll work. But I mean, they're afraid of ChatGPT. I mean, I've already had questions coming to me from faculty members at different schools saying, what do you think about this? Is this going to be a problem? And I mean, immediately I get it. you know, I'm afraid of it in terms of being a teacher or whatever, because I can just very easily imagine this being used for bad things. But every time I hear somebody banning something for the children, in air quotes, I usually run right out and get it. You know, I'm like, you know, when I was a kid and they told me that Kurt Vonnegut was banned in the seventh grade library, guess what I did? I went and got copies of everything Kurt Vonnegut ever wrote and read it. And it didn't seem to hurt me. I mean, look at me now, right? Yeah, I'm okay. But let's talk about this a bit. So the reasoning for banning ChatGPT, of course, the initial reason is that students would use this to plagiarize and cheat. I mean, I can't spell the word plagiarism. I don't know why. I know how to spell it, but I always screw it up. You know, English can be so challenging. You know, it's I before A, except after P or something. Yeah, all those kind of crazy things. But thanks to Grammarly, it's correct. I wrote it correctly. But although Grammarly is telling me my sentences are wordy, and I'm getting tired of that, Grammarly, like, you know, wordy, right? You know, like, bite me. But see, there's a nice concise sentence. But they also worry that ChatGPT may provide students with misinformation. And to me, that's the bigger worry. I mean, this thing is trained on the interweb, right? So you can imagine if your whole worldview and education relied on what people said on Twitter. And I don't know that an AI has the capability to discern and distinguish between, you know, right and wrong, for one thing, and also to discern and distinguish between what's misinformation. I mean, is the earth flat? You know, because that's one of the stupidest conspiracies that ever existed. But people believe this. They have conferences about it. And I asked ChatGPT about it. I was like, okay, let's try this. So I asked ChatGPT, I said, is the earth flat? And here's this response, quote, no, the earth is not flat. It is an oblate spheroid, meaning it is roughly spherical in shape, but slightly flattened at the poles and bulging at the equator, kind of like me, due to the centrifugal force generated by its rotation. This shape has been confirmed through numerous experiments, including satellite imagery and the measurement of Earth's gravitational field. The idea that the Earth is flat is a false belief that has been discredited by the scientific community for centuries, more than centuries even. The overwhelming evidence supports that the conclusion that the Earth is a roughly spherical object. It didn't go on to say, you're an idiot. But, I mean, it didn't have a bunch of misinformation in it. It didn't say, but for balance, let me also tell you about this. You know, cavemen rode dinosaurs or whatever. I mean, but all that stuff's out on the internet, right? So it's a little bit scary. So, I mean, it doesn't tell me with this simple experiment that ChatGPT is any more incorruptible or not subject to misinformation than, say, well, I am. But we can, and we remember GIGO, right? Garbage in, garbage out, still applies in all these cases. But, you know, I mean, sometimes I think we hold AI to too high of a standard. You know, we talk about self-driving cars crashing and we make a big fuss about it. But at the same time, I'm like, how many humans crashed their cars this morning? I mean, I live in Rhode Island, you know, the home of stupid car crashes and people backing down the exit ramp and stuff like that. But I mean, at the end of the day, I saw a semi truck coming over here, and in Rhode Island, the belief is that when there's a sign that says lane ending, that you get in that lane. And there was a semi truck who immediately swerved over into the ending lane, you know, for some bizarre reason. And that's supposed to be a trained driver. So, you know, I mean, obviously misinformation applies to humans who are subject to it. And humans are obviously very subject to manipulation for the most part. So I would presume if the training set for an AI could be manipulated in the same way, then that's just like human children getting fed crazy misinformation by their idiotic parents. I mean, it could start spewing the same kind of nonsense those poor kids are going to start spewing when they grow up. I mean, there's always been that kind of concern about neural nets and such, right? I mean, with an AI, it's not really providing citations for what it says, and it may not be very easy to actually examine that hidden layer. That's one of the theoretical concepts behind these things, that hidden layer, and see what weights and so forth uses, just like in a human, right? I mean, I can't look in your head and determine why you believe the earth is flat and you're willing to buy into this dumb conspiracy. And yes, I'm contemptuous of it because math shows you that it's wrong, but you won't believe it because you want to hear all kinds of silly nonsense. But I mean, humans can be convinced that the earth is flat. They can be convinced that vaccines don't work, despite the evidence to the contrary that they don't want to hear. I mean, the statement that it gave me makes complete and perfect sense to me, but where did it come from? There's no math there, and there's no citations there, and even though I already know the math is real because I've studied it otherwise, and I've seen it in other places, but what if I was in the seventh grade? Now I've been told the earth isn't flat. Okay, well, that's a good thing, but what if it changes its point of view later? I mean, so far, I haven't seen a lot of misinformation on ChatGPT, but that doesn't mean it couldn't be there. I mean, I saw a story in the news yesterday about these Nazis, I mean, like actual Nazis in Ohio that are homeschooling their children because they could not find a school that would allow them to have their children learn a Nazi-based curriculum. I mean, I'm not even making this up. I mean, I know it sounds like I'm making it up, but I'm literally not making it up. So that's also a pretty big worry. And then there's plagiarism. Now, honestly, I have always felt that it was really almost impossible to prevent cheating. I mean, whether it was that kid in the third grade you knew that had all the spelling words written on their hand, you know, or on their sleeve or whatever, or the multiplication table was written under carefully placed rips in their jeans, both seen those. Or even in, you know, as a university professor, where I've caught people stealing other people's work, bullying students to give them copies of their work, copying other work, buying assignments, downloading assignments from, you know, various brain dump sites, copying programs from Stack Overflow and turning them in. I mean, I've seen just about everything. I mean, literally. I mean, one school I worked at spent over $200,000 on these plaques to put in the hallways that had copies of the student ethics code because the company that was selling the plaques did a study, which they paid for, and they would not reveal the data behind the study or how they actually did the study, but they claimed that the plaques in the hallway kept people from cheating. Yep. I literally laughed out loud at the presentation. They got upset. I mean, I asked them if they had read Kohlberg, and they did not know what a pre-conventionalist or a post-conventionalist was, so they hadn't really done their research. I had, but they had not. But they said, hey, those plaques work. Our study shows it. We asked students if they were more or less likely to cheat if there was a plaque on the wall, and the students said yes. I laughed out loud again. A pre-conventionalist, if you don't know what Kohlberg's pre-conventionalist is someone who will do something because they believe they won't get caught, which sounds like a lot of hackers we know, right? Like, you get what you deserve because you couldn't catch me. There was no camera, so I stole your wallet. A brass plaque or signing a code that you say, I will not cheat, works just about as well as those codes they used to try to get you to sign that says, I won't get involved in any canoodling with my girlfriend. Yeah, that didn't work either. I mean, we all had to sign that at church school. I don't know about you, but, you know, they were like, sign this. And I'm like, of course I will. Plain and simple. And post-conventionalists are really scary people who believe that they answer to a higher power anyway, which is where you get terrorists and stuff like that from. So whatever they're doing it for other reasons. I mean, of course, this post-conventionalism is the old, I'm cheating because this class is not worth my time. I actually had a student tell me that once in a C programming class. The person said, I don't need to know this, so cheat. You know, when you catch me cheating, it's just because I don't want to waste my time on it. They got an F. But, you know, there's a part of me then that says, but let's not run away in fear of AI. Let's embrace our new supreme overlords, just getting that out there. But I have been telling my students to use it if they want to, but to cite it. You know, so if you use this as a resource, cite it. You do. If you look something up in a journal, what's the difference? And this thing has access to every journal on the internet. So why not just cite it? But you need to use the old journalism technique of verifying what it tells you. Because even if you read a story in the New York Times, you might want to get a citation from another source that verifies that. That's what journalists supposedly do. Not all of them these days, but that's what they're supposed to do. I mean, I watched the Lou Grant show. I mean, it's really handy to get this kind of stuff. Yesterday I was doing a class and I wanted to show my students some networking socket code in different languages. And I could have written it all. I mean, well, not every one of them. I could have written all of it, but I would have taken a lot of time. But I just asked ChatGPT to write it. I said, ChatGPT, write me Python, Rust, Go, and C. And so I wrote four different programs using ChatGPT. It took like 10 minutes. And I was able to show that. And I cited the source on my slides. I wasn't cheating. I wasn't plagiarizing. I cited the source and I told the students where it came from. Now, if I was teaching a class and I wanted them to write that code, I don't know what I would do. That's the problem, right? Because what if they turn that in? How can I distinguish it? But they could also get it off, you know, Stack Overflow or somewhere too, or get their friend Larry to write it. But It provided my students with a bunch of useful info, and it saved me a bunch of time, so it was useful. I did verify that the C and the Python code would work, and the Rust and the Go code did look like they made sense, so I used it. I mean, I don't know where this goes. I really don't. And students are definitely going to use this to cheat. Absolutely. But they're already using everything on Earth to cheat. They're using Course Hero. They're hiring companies that will cheat for you. There's literally companies out there you can hire that just flat out say, why waste your time on this stupid crap in college when you can hire us to do it for you and you can do more important stuff? I mean, cheaters are going to cheat. It sucks. But it's the way it is. And they're typically cheating themselves, right? Because when they do graduate and they go to a job interview and somebody says, hey, could you debug this C code for me? You claim you're a C programmer. And I used to do this all the time to people. And they look at it and go, oh, no. You know, but I mean, they're going to hire somebody named Sid to write their code for them anyway. So I don't know what the answer to that is. And I never have, long before this. But I do think it's a whole new can of Lumbricus terrestris. Which, yes, I asked ChatGPT for the Latin name for worms. Grammarly did not like that either. I may attach Grammarly to ChatGPT, do a sort of writing a grammar cage match, and just see who wins. Probably could sell tickets to that, right? Sounds good. And finally, this story is also about AI and the end of the world. This particular story is about a computer which broadcasts AI-generated Seinfeld episodes for eternity. It's called Watch Me Forever, and it's a Twitch channel from Mismatch Media, which says that their whole purpose is experimental forms of television, video games, and other things using machine learning. The show in question is called Nothing Forever, which was supposedly what the sitcom Seinfeld was about, Nothing. It's an AI-generated romp with Larry Feinberg, Yvonne Torres, Fred Kastopoulos, and Zoltan Kakler, which I presume represents the original sitcom members of Jerry, Elaine, George, and Kramer. The content is being generated by GPT-3, which is another version of ChatGPT. It's like the back end of it. So long after the collapse of civilization, and I'm sitting around eating the remains of a radioactive wombat in the ruins, and yes, I spent a lot of time finding cool bondage gear so I can look like a character in Fury Road, that AI is still going to be sitting there somewhere in the cloud generating one-liners for George Costanza. And that's the news. We'll see you next week on the Security Weekly News. I will be at the Millennial Alliance Transformation CISO Assembly in New Orleans on the 15th and 16th. If you're going to be there, be sure and stop by and say hi. See ya.